Celebrating 25 years on the air. This is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on 96.1 WSBT. The sports leader.
Notre Dame has defeated Louisville 104-101 in five overtimes.
Run! Brian Stavisky! It's the ball game and the Irish will play for another day!
But to the Notre Dame family, I can't say anything except I've been blessed.
The Penn Kingsmen, 5A, state champs.
I think anytime you have a team with Skylar Diggins at the point, you better not count us out.
The Indianapolis Colts select Quentin Nelson.
Charlie Weiss's tenure as Notre Dame's football coach has come to an end.
South Bend, Washington has etched its name into Hoosier Hysteria history.
Out of the 160 minor league teams, South Bend will be the best.
Three and he hits. Demetrius Jackson.
Score, Marshawn! 4-2 Bruins.
Brian Kelly, the new head coach at Notre Dame.
They score! Notre Dame, 3.7 seconds away from a spot in the national championship game.
The Clay Colonials win the state championship. They are living a dream.
Enrique Ogunbowale wins the national championship for Notre Dame.
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
Good evening, everyone. Sports Beat on the air, 7 minutes after 5 o'clock at 96.1. WSBT, the sports leader. I'm WSBT Radio Sports Director Darren Pritchett. From our WSBT studios in Mishawaka, Eric Hansen, the Fighting Irish Football Insider for the South Bend Tribune, is on the road today. He is joining us on the phone for the program. Tonight, we are brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. By the Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. And we're also brought to you by Train, Heating, and Cooling. On the program this evening, our Notre Dame football summer camp series continues as Eric will rank the opponent offenses that Notre Dame will face in 2019. Later on this hour, Javier Baez hit career home run number 100 for the Chicago Cubs yesterday. So is he the most valuable Cub position player currently? Also coming up, the My 5 question of the day. Since there was a little dispute between manager, player, and media member in the Mets clubhouse over the weekend, we have come up with this My 5 question of the day. Eric will answer the five most awkward moments that he has been a part of as a media member. He was around Bob Knight, so that might give you an idea of the direction we could be going in that particular conversation. Also coming up next hour, Matt Nagy, the Bears head coach, is doing something very unique, I would say, in getting his team ready for the upcoming season. We'll have rapid fire. We will talk about the U.S. Senior Open pairings, which are now out, and also have a Chicago Cubs report. And also at the end of next hour, an interview we did recently on the Corona Premier Golf Show with Matt Seelan. He is the superintendent at Warren Golf Course, and he has been front and center preparing Warren Golf Course for the U.S. Senior Open. So Matt will join us with this taped interview coming up a little later on in the program here on WSBT Radio. I was out at Warren today, practice rounds for the U.S. Senior Open. Not as many players on the golf course today. Many of the players from the Champions Tour were up in Madison, Wisconsin, taking part in an event there, which concluded yesterday. So today, a travel day for many players, others just taking a little downtime before they get going for this national championship at Warren. A lot of guys on the practice range, of course, and I was out there for probably about 30 minutes on the practice range and saw Lee Jansen, a two-time U.S. Open champion on the range. Miguel Angel Jimenez and Fred Funk were side-by-side hitting golf balls. In fact, if you follow my Twitter account, 961 SportsBeat, I have video of Funk, Jimenez, and Jansen hitting from the tee at Warren today. So you can check that out if you're into golf. And Budweiser's Weekday SportsBeat will go live from Warren Golf Course from 4 to 7, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then Saturday morning's Corona Premier Golf Show is live from Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame. So a lot of coverage from the U.S. Senior Open. We'll be able to get some audio from the players as they come off the course on Thursday and Friday, and we'll bring that to you in our special show from 4 until 7, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, live from Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame. So that's what's coming up here over the next little bit. In this opening segment, we'll continue our Notre Dame football summer camp series. We started this last week. We continue this week. And tomorrow, we're going to rank opponent defenses that the Irish will face. Today, we're going to rank opponent offenses that Clark Lee's defense will go head-to-head against this fall as the Irish take on 12 teams on their regular season schedule. And Eric, let me just start by asking, what types of things are you looking for and looking at to rank these opponent offenses that the Irish will be facing this year? And I think we lost Eric there. Let me go to line two. Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me, Darren?
I can now. We had some phone issues, but they're now secured.
Darren, can you hear me?
Okay. Eric cannot hear me, so we will just move on here for a couple of moments and try to fix our little technical difficulty, which I don't know how to fix as I'm looking at the board right now. But we shall press on. I'll tell you what, let's take a break. Let's see if we can get reorganized, and we'll come back with something, I promise. Here as SportsBeat continues on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. 14 minutes after the top of the hour, SportsBeat continues on WSBT Radio. Our Notre Dame football summer camp series, ready to get rolling here, ranking opponent offenses that the Irish will face this year. That's our topic today. And Eric Hansen, why don't you go ahead and set the stage what you're looking for from opponent offenses when ranking them? Are you projecting? Are you taking a look at last year? How are you formulating this group?
Well, I start with taking a look at last year, and then I look at who's come back, if they have coordinator changes, you know, what their losses look like. But it's interesting, Darren, because as a group, this was not a good group of offenses last year. Seven of them ranked 65th or lower in total offense. Four of them ranked 105th or lower in total offense. And only one of them was in the top 48 total offenses of the country.
Okay, so let's start ranking these opponent offenses. We'll start, Eric, with number 12. This is the offense you expect to be the weakest that Notre Dame will face this year.
Bowling Green wasn't very good offensively. That's why they have a new head coach in Scott Loeffler and new coordinators and so forth. But in May, after their spring practice was done, their starting quarterback decided to up and leave, enter the transfer portal, and popped up at West Virginia. So they're really starting from scratch. If that happened before spring practice, I think I'd be a little bit more optimistic about good things happening. But this is going to be a difficult situation for Bowling Green, and the fact that they don't have a very good defense doesn't help.
Okay, next up in our ranking, the opponent offenses that Notre Dame will face this year, the second weakest, number 11.
Well, I'm going to tell you what. New Mexico has 13 junior college transfers on the roster, so that's kind of a wild card. Again, this is one of those teams that were ranked in the hundreds in total offense. They really weren't good at anything. They weren't good in the running game. They weren't good at pass efficiency. They didn't protect their quarterback. They turned the ball over a lot. So you're really kind of starting from scratch and trying to create an offense that can be competitive. So New Mexico, number 11.
Are they still an option team?
They are no longer an option team. They ditched that a couple of years ago, and the transition has been a little bit choppy going back to a conventional, because you have to recruit to that, you know.
Sure. Notre Dame football summer camp series, Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett with you, ranking opponent offenses. We're now up to the 10th best offense that Clark Lee's defense will face this year.
Well, Louisville was another one of those disasters that were hovering in the hundreds in the bottom 10 or 20 offenses in the country. But I think a lot of their dysfunction was the coaching staff. I think that there's some talent there. Their left tackle is, you know, highly coveted by NFL teams already going into his junior year. Juwan Pass is a decent quarterback, although he wasn't able to pull away in that competition in the spring. think that actually speaks to the depth at quarterback rather than Juwan not being super good as a quarterback. So I think there's hope there, Darren, that they're going to make some progress. Now, I wouldn't expect that in September, but I think as the season goes on, with Scott Satterfield as the brand-new coach, placing Bobby Petrino, I think eventually you're going to have an offense that can be a little bit more respectable, a little bit more competitive.
Okay, next up in ranking opponent offenses that Notre Dame will face this year, how about team number 9?
You know, Duke had Daniel Jones as their quarterback last year and a pretty good running back and pretty good wide receivers, and they didn't produce the kind of offense that you would associate with a quarterback that went in high in the first round. And so they lose, out of those components, they lose the quarterback and they lose 3 top receivers. Now, I think the hope here is that David Cutcliffe is a really good coach, and he is, but I think they're going to struggle to score points. I just don't see them, you know, I think they're going to have to rely on their defense more than their offense to get themselves wins this year.
Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett talking Notre Dame football on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, 19 minutes after the top of the hour. Notre Dame football summer camp series ranking Notre Dame's offenses that they will face on the 2019 schedule, up to team number 8.
Well, 8 is Navy, and this is kind of a bizarre situation. They felt like Malcolm Perry was going to be maybe the best quarterback they ever had. They just had a guy that's one of the best option quarterbacks ever leave their team a couple years ago. And then 5 games in, they felt like this wasn't the answer. They moved Malcolm Perry back to slot back. They get to the end of the season, they're 3-9. They said, you know what, let's put him back at quarterback. I'll tell you, Darren, he's a brilliant runner. Notre Dame hasn't seen much of him at quarterback. They've seen him as a slot back. The rub against Malcolm is when Navy has to pass or when they want to pass, he can't do it. And there are points in games where they have to do it, especially if they're behind. So I'm not sure that this is going to be a lasting change. You know, and they're paired with, whenever Navy's paired with a defense that's below average, it seems to hurt their offense. It puts too much pressure on it. And I think that's still kind of where Navy is this year, so that's why they're not my number 8.
Okay, so the midshipmen, number 8, team number 7.
Well, I think Virginia has a quarterback, and I'm not sure that they have a whole lot to go around that. You know, Bronco Mendenhall has really accelerated that program's growth by making the defense better. And I think the offense has to play catch-up. And so I think they're going to be okay scoring points. I just don't think this is a, you know, offense where you kind of hold your breath and say, my goodness, how are we going to stop these guys? And again, this is all good for Notre Dame's defense because, you know, they're going to have some growing pains early in the season as well.
There's a lot of optimism about Virginia. I've read a lot about that. They have a lot of starters back on both sides of the football. So all of a sudden, this is a team that's being talked about as a preseason top 25 team. But it sounds like you feel like the quarterback's going to have to carry a lot on his shoulders.
I do. I think, you know, he's a dual threat kind of guy. And I think he's going to be doing a lot of both running and throwing, and he needs more support around him. I think that they do have returning starters, but they weren't a very good offense last year. So, you know, they need to bump it up. That's the next stage of evolution for that program, is to have an offense that's better than average, which they weren't last year.
Notre Dame football summer camp series ranking opponent offenses that the Irish will face this year. Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett with you. Now to the top 6, 12 through 7, Bowling Green, New Mexico, Louisville, Duke, Navy, and Virginia. Now team number 6.
I'm going to go with Virginia Tech here, which could be high for them.
Yeah.
I like Ryan Willis as a quarterback. Apparently, they don't. They have a quarterback competition that's going to continue into August for them. And maybe Ryan Willis will beat it, and maybe he won't. But they had a lot of people in the transfer portal. The one weapon I really like on their team is Damone Hazleton, the Ball State transfer, who was their leading receiver. He was one of their few offensive players that didn't jump into the transfer portal. But that team chemistry just seems suspect to me. But I think they have the makings to be, you know, okay on offense, which puts them at number six. So they may be high. I'm high on this list. I may have overestimated them.
Okay, teams like USC, Michigan, Georgia have not been named yet. Stanford. So we move along to team number five, Eric, as we rank from worst to best the opponent offenses that Notre Dame will face this year.
Well, the thing that I like Boston College is they always seem to have a pretty good offensive line. I think Anthony Brown has gotten better and better as a quarterback. And then you stick A.J. Dillon, a 6-foot, 250-pound running back, in the middle of that offense. And they've got some good backups, including Ron Dane's kid is on their team out of ninth spring game. So they have a rotation of running backs to help out A.J. Dillon. So the thing that I like about Boston College is their offense. So they come in at number five for me.
Eric, obviously we joke a lot about Coach Davey and what he's doing at New Mexico, his time here. But in all seriousness, Steve Adazio was on his coaching staff, and I remember he was the offensive coordinator at Florida for a while, maybe under Urban Meyer, if I remember correctly. And he has really evolved into a really nice head football coach. What he is doing at Boston College, winning in a Northeast city with not a lot of recruiting of great players around him, he has made them very, very competitive. They're going to bowl games. And honestly, I don't know if you can ask a whole lot more if you're an administrator or a fan at Boston College.
I would agree with you. They are very good in their player evaluations. They get players that maybe are overlooked by other people, and they develop them very well. And if you see stars on both sides of the ball, all of a sudden they'll have a defensive back that's, you know, the pros are looking at, or defensive ends. You know, the problem is they don't have all of them together all at once. You know, usually there's a deficiency on one side of the ball or the other. But I'll tell you what, I mean, when you look at all the 2- and 3-star kids that end up at Boston College that turn into pros, he's doing something right.
Yeah. Well, that defense that he put on the field against Notre Dame at Fenway Park was awfully good. They had some really good players in that secondary.
Absolutely.
Okay, we have four teams left as we rank the opponent offenses that Notre Dame will face this year in no particular order: USC, Michigan, Georgia, and Stanford. Pretty good quarterbacks left on this list. We will go now to number four.
I'm going to go with Stanford here, and I toy between bumping them up to three or leaving them at four. KJ Costello, I think, is an outstanding quarterback, and he had to carry too much of the burden of that offense last year. Their offensive line didn't kind of live up to what their talent level was there. They didn't have the chemistry and the health, and they have some of those same issues in the spring, but they've got some big-time offensive linemen. The thing is, do they have a running back that can balance that offense? Do they have running backs that can do it? Because Bryce Love was just so banged up most of the year last year, and his backups really couldn't come close to the level that Bryce Love was. Maybe Lance Taylor needs to be coaching their running backs, because they were awfully good when he was their running back coach. But I think KJ Costello, I'll tell you what, I mean, for people that knew that burden of the offense was on him, he did a heck of a job being a very efficient, very effective quarterback when, again, there wasn't much semblance of a running game.
Eric, and this is obviously no disrespect to what we have here. This is just hypothetically speaking. If KJ Costello was on the Notre Dame roster, I'd be very happy if he was my quarterback. I think that much of him and what he has done out at Stanford recently. Once he became the starter, and despite they've had some injuries, he's done some really good things for that offense, overcoming, I think, some tough circumstances.
I do, too, and I don't evaluate players on how they will be as pros unless they're Notre Dame players, and I talk to people that do that for a living. But I'll tell you what, as a college quarterback, I'd want him on my team.
Yeah. Okay, three teams left as we rank the opponent offenses the Irish will face this year. Who is number three?
Well, the best thing about USC's offense is, from a media standpoint, is we won't ever have to hear someone on TV saying, you know, he really should still be in high school because he shouldn't be next year. He'll be a sophomore in college. You know, he came out a year early from high school, grew a mustache, I think, so people would recognize him as a college student. Where USC had issues, and they didn't have them as much against Notre Dame. They had a pretty good game plan, but they also need to balance their offense. Their running game needs to be better. There was just too much pressure on JT Daniel throughout the year. But the one thing they do have, Darren, in spades, is they have wide receivers that are outstanding speed guys, very difficult covers. They have them in abundance. The thing that I would say is a little bit iffy with their offense is if they can get their offensive line play to be elite. But other than that, they have all the ingredients to be a really good offense. And they have a new offensive coordinator, Graham Harrell. It'll be interesting to see if he is very Cliff Kingsbury-like, or if, you know, he's not quite at that level, because that's who their offensive coordinator was going to be for about a month before he jumped into the NFL.
Okay, Eric, we're down to two teams, and I get the feeling since we've started doing this football summer camp series, and with the ones we have left, these two might be near the top in most of our categories. We're down to Michigan and Georgia, so who is the number two offense that the Irish will face this season?
Going to be Michigan, and Michigan's offense wasn't as good last year as maybe you might think it would be if they weren't. They were 49th in total offense, which is kind of middle of the pack. You know, they had some really good pieces that didn't all come together. But here's the thing. People that cover Michigan are saying this could be their best offensive line in a long, long time. That group has really come light years from 2 years ago, and certainly in the opener against ND. Shea Patterson, I don't think he's the savior that everybody thought he was going to be, but I think he's a pretty good quarterback. I think they have very good wide receivers, too, and they're very deep at that position. My question is, who's going to carry the ball? How good are they going to be in the run game? Hickman is no longer on their team. He graduated and is going to the NFL. And then Evans was suspended. So they're going to have to come up with somebody new out of the blue to carry the ball for them. And the other thing that I think Michigan fans are excited about is Coach Gattis, who came from Alabama, is going to be their offensive coordinator. And he has not coordinated an offense on the college level before, but people really like their ideas. They like the fact that it's going to be an up-tempo, no-level offense, and that supposedly Jim Harbaugh will not have his hands on the steering wheel at all. Now, I'll believe that when I see it. Just like it took us a while to believe that Chip Long was going to do that and Brian Kelly was going to be hands-off. So, they kind of had a hybrid offense last year where they got a little bit into the spread concepts. They still retain some of the Jim Harbaugh pullback, kind of thing. They were kind of in between. I think committing to one offense fully, I think, is going to help them. So I think they'll be better than the 49th offense in the country, but I'll believe it more if I see their running game come along.
Eric, I'll say this. I recall preparing for the Michigan game last year, and we really thought one of the weaknesses of the football team was going to be that offensive line because of the way they played 2 years ago. But I would have to say that was one of the more improved parts of any team that the Irish faced last year. And the fact that that group is back together, ready to go once again this year, I can understand you saying how you feel like this Michigan offensive line could be one of the better ones the Irish face this year.
Yeah, I think they will be. And, you know, when you have a good offensive line, that's a good basis for building an offense. When you look at a lot of these other teams toward the bottom, their offensive lines were in shambles, and that's why, you know, they were in the 100s. You know, they turned the ball over because the quarterback was always under pressure. They couldn't run the ball. They got one-dimensional. So, yeah, I think it helps Michigan a lot that their offensive line is supposed to be this good. And, you know, Ed Warner, the former Notre Dame offensive line coach, is their offensive line coach now.
Well, Wednesday, we're going to have Eric rank the opponent quarterbacks from worst to best. So I'm really interested to see where you have Patterson from Michigan. Okay, today, ranking opponent offenses. Here are what we have so far. Number 12, Bowling Green. Then New Mexico, Louisville, and Duke. 8 through 5 is Navy, Virginia, Virginia Tech, Boston College. Number 4, KJ Costello and Stanford. Number 3, USC. Shea Patterson and Michigan coming in at number 2. And that leaves us with number 1, Eric, and you're going to go with the Georgia Bulldogs.
I am, and I don't think it's even close. And I think even with Holman getting thrown off the team, and he's gone for good. This is, you know, first quarter suspension, domestic violence allegations against him. He's no longer part of the program. That was their top returning receiver. I still think they have a lot of good weapons. Jake Fromm is going to be one of the best quarterbacks in the country. They're no longer doing the two-quarterback thing, which really didn't work with them. And Justin Fields, in fact, I think in the SEC championship game, it hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
I think even though they lost some running backs, they still have very good running backs coming back. And I think Georgia also is going to have an elite offensive line. I would be shocked if they were not finalists for the Joe Moore Award this year. So you have a lot of really good ingredients. They're going to have to develop some younger wide receivers and maybe get Demetrius Robertson on the field. But I'll tell you what, the kid's fast. I mean, he may be flaky, but he's fast. So I like Georgia.
Okay, so Georgia, the best offense the Irish will face this year, according to Fighting Irish Football Insider for the South Bend Tribune, Eric Hansen. I'm Darren Pritchett. It is 25 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Coming up on tomorrow's Notre Dame football summer camp series, Eric ranks opponent defenses that Chip Long and the Irish offense will face this year. Will it come down to Michigan and Georgia once again? Tune in tomorrow and find out. Coming up Wednesday, we rank the opponent quarterbacks. And then Thursday, Eric will rank the 12 best players on the Fighting Irish roster, regardless of position. And then we wrap up Friday with a look at the schedule, and we'll rank basically the easiest game to the most difficult, factoring in possible weather, who's on a bye, all sorts of things. That's what we have the rest of the week during our Notre Dame football summer camp series. We're going to talk some baseball next. Javier Baez reaches a milestone for the Cubs. And it was quite the interesting weekend in St. Louis. You saw things that you've really never seen before and may not again for a while. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments as Sports Beat continues. Brought to you by Budweiser, Train Heating and Cooling, and the Food Bank of Northern Indiana on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. It is 21 minutes in front of the top of the hour. This is Budweiser's weekday Sports Beat from 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader. The South Bend Cubs have the day off today. They're back in action tomorrow at the Fort Wayne Tin Caps. First pitch at 7:05, the pregame at 6:50 here on WSBT Radio. I'm Darren Pritchett from our WSBT studios. Eric Hansen is the Fighting Irish Football Insider for the South Bend Tribune. He is on the road this afternoon working on assignment for the Tribune and joins us on the phone here on WSBT Radio. We've got a couple of baseball topics to get to. But, Eric, something that you can pass along for our listeners of Notre Dame women's basketball, the Irish have made some headlines today.
Yeah, and I want to say it's Irish Sports Daily was the first to report this. I'd like to give them the credit. We're trying to track it down right now. Apparently, Jordan Nixon, a backup point guard last year for Notre Dame, is in the transfer portal. She would have been in line to compete for a starting job. Now, they have a lot of point guard types on the roster right now. Not sure what prompted her to get into the transfer portal, but we'll have, I would assume, we'll have details on this tomorrow. Anthony Anderson, who's our beat writer, is on it right now. But numbers are really thin for Notre Dame now. Center in the big people category, but, you know, at this point, Notre Dame really can't afford to be losing players off their roster just because it's such a small roster.
Jordan Nixon, 5'8", from New York City, a sophomore this upcoming season. She averaged 14.5 minutes per game for the Irish in 26 games. She scored in 15 of the 26 contests that she played in. Now, she was a little banged up as well, had a hamstring injury, and returned during the ACC tournament. And this is a player that played in the McDonald's All-American game back in 2018. So, again, according to Irish Sports Daily, Jordan Nixon in that transfer portal, the 5'8 sophomore to be from New York City. And since we're talking about some Notre Dame sports right now, it's worth mentioning that the Irish hockey team had another player selected by an NHL team over the weekend. And Trevor Janicki, a fifth-round pick of the Anaheim Ducks, and his father played at the University of Notre Dame back in the 1990s. And so he becomes the 85th player in Notre Dame history to be taken and the National Hockey League draft, and I'm going off the top of my head here, but I think that's now 16 straight years at least one Notre Dame player has been drafted, and he is an incoming freshman for this Fighting Irish hockey team. And from what I'm told, it sounds like a guy that could be able to put some points on the board right away for this Fighting Irish hockey team. So there's a little hockey news as well.
Eric, I got a question about that. Can I ask it?
You may. Go right ahead.
Okay, so for people that don't follow the NHL draft, so there's no chance he just says, forget it, I'm not going to Notre Dame. This is just kind of a formality that he'll be their property until he eventually signs. Is that how it works?
It's a process that can be mind-numbing at times. Theoretically, okay, anybody that is drafted could sign with their NHL team if the NHL team wanted them at that time. So, yeah, there's a possibility. We've had in the last 10 years a couple of guys never arrive on campus as they signed with their NHL team or they went to a Canadian junior team. But the way I understand it, Eric, is the best way to put it is using Janicki as an example. He is the property of Anaheim until a month or two after his senior season is complete. So they have until then to sign him. The best high-end players would likely leave after their third year. That seems to be the norm across college hockey. For example, Andrew Peak, our captain, was drafted by Columbus in the second round. He stayed 3 years, signed after his junior season. And then there's Vinny Hinostroza, who was drafted by the Blackhawks. He left after his sophomore season. So anything is possible, but Eric, from my standpoint, if you get a great player for 3 years in college hockey, that's pretty doggone good. It's hard to keep them much longer because the NHL teams then worry if you wait until after that senior year, they have to sign them or they could lose them to free agency. Like Thomas DePaoli was a Capitals draft pick. He didn't sign. He signed with the Penguins instead. And you might remember Cal Peterson, our goaltender, was drafted by Buffalo, elected not to sign, and he ended up with the LA Kings organization. So it's actually something I would like to see baseball try. To me, it would be something that would, I think, help the college game if you could get these major league teams to agree to let some of these guys go to college for a year or two. But I also understand they want these guys in their hands and start developing them. So probably not something that's going to happen. But I think a lot of NHL teams love when one of their players is going to Notre Dame. They know they're going to be taught the game at a high level, and they're going to be players that will be able to come in and contribute right away, either in the AHL or at the NHL level. So I think most teams don't mind players playing for Jeff Jackson and the Fighting Irish for 3 years. That's a positive.
And they don't mind you announcing about them.
They could care less. They don't have any idea who I am, that's for sure. All right, how about yesterday at Wrigley Field?
Fly ball out into right. That ball is gone! Number 100, Cubs lead.
Well, it's been a tough go for Baez of late. This hanging slider crushed.
That was NBC Sports Chicago. Len Casper and Jim Deshays on the call. Cubs were trailing in the eighth inning until Javier Baez belted a home run, a three-run shot to put the Cubs in front to stay. They beat the Metropolitans by a score of 5-3. So the question is, Javier Baez, with his career 100th home run yesterday, is he the most viable Cub position player currently on the roster?
That's a good question. I'll tell you what, if I had to draft off that team, I think I would take him. I would take him or the catcher, Contreras.
I would definitely take Javier Baez right now as my number one position player because he plays a premium position. He's a shortstop, but he also has the versatility to play another premium position, third base. He is excellent at second base, but I almost hate to waste his glove. If you've got two great gloves at short and third or two great bats, that's a different story. But I like where Baez is right now playing shortstop. They play Russell at second base, Bodie at second base. I just feel like with his power and still more upside, I would actually say Baez is more valuable than Chris Bryant. That's hard to say, knowing Bryant's won an MVP award. But he's a guy they've moved to the outfield. He is not really in the same class of fielding at third base as Nolan Arenado of the Colorado Rockies. So it's not like Bryant is a lock that you'd like him at third base. You can move him to the outfield. You don't really lose anything in the outfield. I just think Baez, because he plays a premium position at a high level and the bat is continuing to get better, he's more selective. To me, he would be the guy I'm most focused on signing long-term out of everybody on that roster. And I agree with you with the way Contreras has bounced back offensively, matching up with his defense. He is a high-end caliber catcher for that Chicago Cubs team.
Amen.
And finally, what a weird 3 days in St. Louis is Albert Pujols, the former Cardinal who left for free agency after the 2011 World Championship season, came back to St. Louis as a player for the first time over the weekend. A scheduling quirk had the Cardinals going to L.A. a couple of times to take on the Angels. So he came back and got standing ovations every time he stepped to the plate. He hit the home run on Saturday and got a loud ovation from the fans. They actually encouraged and got a curtain call from Pujols. And then last night, with the Cardinals down 2-0 in the ninth, Pujols came up for his final at-bat ever at Busch Stadium. Bases loaded, nobody at the game's on the line, and some of the fans are chanting, "Albert, Albert," they're cheering. They wanted him to get a hit. So what does that tell you? Anything in particular? Or is that just fans wanted to see a great moment?
I'll tell you what, I was watching and saying that to myself. It's weird. It's Darren, have the Angels come back to say, you know, and Pujols come back to St. Louis, let's say a year or two or even three out from that free agent signing. I'm not so sure he wouldn't have been booed by some people, and I think there was bitterness on both sides, but there seems to be this forgiveness and there is this remembrance, and some of it is because he's not the player he used to be, and it's worked out for the Cardinals not having him on their team. But you remember this great player for 11 years that helped take you to a couple of world championships, and all of a sudden he seemed like that Albert again. And I have to admit, Darren, I wanted him to do well. I wanted the Cardinals to win. I'm a Cardinals fan. But I wanted Albert to, like, you know, I loved when he hit the home run on Saturday. And I watched those games. And normally I don't tear myself away to watch that many full games in a row. And I watched those games because Albert was in them. So it was one of the neatest things. I mean, it gave me goosebumps to hear the people cheering for him and chanting his name. And, you know, he made the out in the night last night. And, you know, Yachty hugged him again, kind of pat him on the back. And, you know, it was pretty neat. I mean, it was, you know, I don't think it makes you wonder what might have been. It just makes you appreciate what was.
There was awkwardness in the ninth inning. Fans didn't know whether to cheer or not in between pitches, just because it was a really weird spot. They wanted Albert to do well. They wanted the Cardinals to win the game. There's a part of me that says, yeah, this is all about Albert. There's a small part of me that says the city and the fan base knows this is a flawed team that should not be two games out. They should be probably seven or eight games back, and they will be probably soon. I think the fan base knows this is an extremely flawed team. They're not going to do anything special, so why not have Albert have his moment? And today, their closer, Jordan Hicks, had a torn UCL confirmed, so he's probably out for a year and a half. So the St. Louis tumble could be starting very, very soon.
Well, again, I thought that was really neat, and it's one of the reasons why I'm a baseball fan.
Yeah.
You know, there's really only one team other than my grandson's baseball teams that I root for, and that's the St. Louis Cardinals. You know, I don't root for pro basketball teams, really, or pro football teams, and in college sports, I need to be objective. But St. Louis is the one kind of entity I allow myself to be a crazy, impatient, weirdo fan. And I qualify on all.
Eric Hansen, Darren Pritchett with you. There's a lot of charm with baseball. It may not be the most exciting game for people, but there's a lot of charm in the great old game. When we come back, so there was a little uneasiness in the Mets locker room at Wrigley Field involving a media member, a player, and the Mets manager, and there had to be some apologies that took place. So we're going to ask this, My Five, in response to that. So what are the five most awkward moments that Eric has been a part of as a media member through the years? Answers coming up next. It is now 7 minutes in front of the top of the hour at WSBT.
One question, five answers. This is the My Five Question of the Day on Michiana's Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
All right, here's today's My Five Question of the Day. And it centers from what happened yesterday at Wrigley Field. The Mets have apologized after a Newsday reporter was confronted by Mets manager Mickey Callaway and pitcher Jason Vargas. So, what are the five most awkward moments that Eric has been a part of as a media member? We'll have some fun with this particular My Five. Eric, take it away. We'll start with number five.
Back when I was covering basketball and football, the Big Ten was my beat. And I covered an IU game, and Bill Belinsky was with me, my sports editor. And about on 3 hours sleep, we drove up to Chicago for the Big Ten basketball press conferences. And the caffeine wasn't working anymore. That's my excuse for doing this. And so Judd Heathcote's up there talking about his team. And he had a local kid on his team called Kurt Vance, who was one of David Haw's teammates in high school. So he's up there, and they're taking questions. And I said, Coach, can you enlighten us about what kind of season you're expecting from Kurt Vance this season? He goes, well, about the same as I said about 5 minutes ago. So he was very kind about it. He repeated the answer and was very classy about it and tried not to make me feel stupid, but everybody else did. So, and I deserved it.
Okay, awkward moment number four.
Number four, I was working on a book project for a friend of mine, and it was Ohio State project. And I don't get starstruck talking to anybody. But I did this once, and it was a guy named Rex Kern, who was Ohio State's quarterback when they won the national championship in 1968. And he's who I, when I was a little kid, wanted to grow up to be. So here was the first time I was meeting him, and it was a phone interview. And he was as awesome as I kind of thought he would be. And so one of my colleagues decided to, that they wanted to borrow my tape recorder, and I wasn't around to ask. Now, they didn't take over the interview, but what they did was when they took the tape, cassette tape, out of the tape recorder, it caught on something on it, and all the tape came out, and it ripped. So I had to call him back and tell him that I needed to do the interview all over again. And so that was pretty awkward and humbling. And you know what? He couldn't have been nicer.
Okay, 2 minutes left. Let's move along to number three.
Three was the infamous Bob Davie teleconference with a person right before me. This is his first year with ESPN. Asked him, isn't it tough living in South Bend, reading the paper and reading about what team Notre Dame has? And he goes, I don't get that right, the South Bend trip. And then the next thing was, next up on the teleconference, Eric Hansen, South Bend Tribune.
Of course
I'm no way bitter. In no way do I have a chip on my shoulder.
Number two.
Number two was the Charlie Weiss press conference, where I had written a column where it was kind of in second person. And Charlie was just waiting for me to ask a question. It wasn't a bad question. It was about Jimmy Clausen. And he goes, now, do you want me to answer that in first person, second person, or third person? He goes, oh, wait a minute. You have all the answers. Next question.
And number one.
Number one. Gene Tierney would have this luncheon where fans were kind of gathered around, and they'd have the volume down on the teleconference people until it was actually time. One year they didn't have the volume down, and Reggie Hayes from Fort Wayne and I were talking, and Reggie Hayes goes, did you do the Bob Knight teleconference today as a joke because he didn't have one? And I said, no, I forgot the phone number, and he said it's 1-800-EXPLETIVE. And there was this roar from the crowd because the volume was turned up and they were listening to our conversation.
That's fantastic. Eric, we have about 15 seconds. What's coming up in the Tribune?
Possible Jordan Nixon transfer, Carter all over recruiting, and much, much more.
Eric, thank you so much. Same top of the hour, WSBT South Bend.
Celebrating 25 years on the air. This is Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat on 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
Notre Dame has defeated Louisville 104-101 in five overtimes.
Run! Brian Stavisky! It's the ball game, and the Irish will play for another day!
But to the Notre Dame family, I can't say anything except I've been blessed.
The Penn Kingsmen, 5A. State champs.
I think anytime you have a team with Skylar Diggins at the point, you better not count us out.
The Indianapolis Colts select Quentin Nelson.
Charlie Weiss's tenure as Notre Dame's football coach has come to an end.
South Bend, Washington has etched its name into Hoosier Hysteria history.
Out of the 160 minor league teams, South Bend will be the best.
Three and he hits. Demetrius Jackson.
Score, Marshawn! 4-2 Bruins.
Brian Kelly, the new head coach at Notre Dame.
The Cubs win the World Series!
They score! Notre Dame, 3.7 seconds away from a spot in the national championship game!
The Clay Colonials win the state championship. They are living a dream.
Enrique Ogunbowale wins the national championship for Notre Dame!
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Styers.
It is 7 minutes after the top of the hour. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat continues on WSBT Radio. along with Sean Stiers. I'm Darren Pritchett. Great to have you with us on this Monday evening. Hopefully you had a wonderful weekend, and we're back and ready to go another week here on WSBT Radio. It's going to be a little busy here at WSBT Radio as Sports Beat goes to 3 hours from 4 to 7, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, as I'll be broadcasting from Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame, site of the 2019 U.S. Senior Open. Wednesday is the final day of practice and a bunch of media sessions, including Steve Stricker, one of the favorites at the U.S. Senior Open. And we'll be bringing you some of the coverage of that press conference and other golfers that come in. I think Colin Montgomery is scheduled to talk that day as well. So we'll have that for you on Wednesday. Thursday, the first round gets underway. And on the first tee, in the first grouping, is Chris Smith, a local golfer who used to be on the PGA Tour. So he's going to be going out at 7:30 on Thursday morning. We'll talk more about some of the featured pairings in just a little bit. But we have Chris Smith from just down the road. He's going to be in the U.S. Senior Open. So we will have 3 hours of coverage Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. It's going to be fun. And on Thursday and Friday, off the 18th green, there's going to be areas where we can just talk to golfers as they come off. So I'm sure
that'd be really cool.
There's going to be some very familiar names and voices that you will hear Thursday and Friday right here as we go 4 to 7 from the U.S. Senior Open on WSBT Radio. So we have a little something going on extra.
Good stuff. Good stuff. I drove by there, when was that? 2 days ago on Saturday. There's a lot of activity. Practice rounds and stuff, were they already starting over the weekend? Is that kind of...
Nope, today. Well,
just today?
There were probably some guys that are not on the Champions Tour in Madison yesterday that might have been rolling in.
Okay.
But today was more of a travel day, I think, for the guys, and maybe some players hit some balls. Not as many guys were out on the golf course today, but tomorrow... I know Tom Watson will be out there for the first time playing a practice round. And all the big names probably will be on the golf course tomorrow. So all I was right out there today for a little bit and watched some guys hit off the driving range. And there are a few players like Bernhard Langer that was out on the golf course getting some yardages, hitting some shots. But I'm sure it's going to be more intense tomorrow and Wednesday out at Warren. And I'll say this, and I'll probably talk more about this on Wednesday, but it's interesting, for those of us that have played at Warren and enjoy Warren, you think of it the way we play it. Then you install the grandstands and the USGA flags and those classic USGA posts that says the hole, the par, and the yardage.
Yep.
And you look at the rough being double the size and the greens just looking like an ice rink. The golf course looks so much more difficult. And I don't know if it's because I see the USGA signs and the flags and the grandstands.
You're just thinking about it, yeah.
If it makes it look more difficult, because it is a tough track when we play it. Don't get me wrong. I broke 80 once there, and I don't play much anymore. That was probably 6-7 years ago when I was actually playing. I played once in the last 3 years, I'll be honest. But it just feels so different. And I don't know if it's because I know this is a national championship, or if it truly just looks more difficult because of the rough and the greens and everything just doesn't look normal. It's interesting. I don't know. Maybe my eyes are playing tricks on me, but it just looks so much more difficult than what we're used to playing. And that's still a pretty tough golf course when we play it. So I can't wait to see what the scores are. Wish it would stop raining because we want to try this course out because we want it to be firm for the weekend, so these small greens really will be tested, and we'll see if the old ball bounces a little bit more rather than spins on the greens at Warren. But eventually, it's going to have to dry out, and it sounds like that might be coming later on this week. So,
I was gonna say, it's, what I'm looking at right now says Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are supposed to be pretty good.
I feel like we've said that a lot. Hey, it's going to be good for a few days. And then here comes the rain. And, of course, you know, our best to all the folks on the south side of South Bend where that tornado touched down last night. Just tough pictures to look at as you watch the news earlier today. Just want to mention this quick. I'm not sure how many people this affects. So let me just go 30 seconds on this, then we'll move on. But the South Bend Cubs announced today that they have begun to issue refunds to ticket holders for the Pitbull concert that was canceled on Sunday, June the 16th. Fans who purchased tickets with cash must bring the tickets to the South Bend Cubs box office for a full refund. Fans who purchased tickets with a credit card either can call the box office or come by the box office in person. And if you would like to hold on to your tickets to see if it's rescheduled or not, you can do so, but all ticket holders will have 60 days to request a refund. And refunds are limited to tickets, not the beer you bought or the popcorn you bought, but the tickets. So if you want more information, you can go to southbendcubs.com for all of the details on the refunds for the Pitbull concert that was canceled on June the 16th. So those refunds are now available. You have 60 days to take advantage of this.
All right.
SouthBendCubs.com for all the little details that I did not mention. This is an interesting NFL story, and it involves the Chicago Bears, which you can hear once again this year on our sister station, Z94.3 FM. You might recall in the playoffs, and Bears fans, you do recall, that the Bears had a chance to beat the Eagles, but just couldn't get it done as Cody Parkey hit the upright, and he hit the bar going across, and the field goal would not go. Just one of many times that he hit posts during the 2018 season. And I don't want to say it cost the Bears victory, because there's other things the offense and the defense could have done to win the game.
Every game, yep.
But at the same time, that field goal goes through, they're moving on to the next round. Well, according to various reports, Bears head coach Matt Nagy has showed video of the Parkey doink over and over to his team, trying to use it as motivation for the upcoming season. And I'm just wondering, is there only so many times you can see that where that loses its effect? Now, I could see starting a camp that you have with your team as you start a new year to show that, and let's tell our team that, let's don't make this come down to the field goal kicker in 2019. But from what we have read, he has shown this video a lot to his team. So do you think that video loses its effect after you show it so many times?
Well, I would think that it loses its effect, and that it also, I mean, using negative images to try to motivate. I don't get it, because one, that field goal was out of just about everyone's hands with the exception of one person, and he's not even on the team anymore. The guy who kicked it isn't even on the team anymore, and there's still the case that maybe that was partially blocked or whatever. But, I mean, I would think that it would be like you or me. We do play-by-play, and occasionally you listen back to your stuff. You try to hone the good and get rid of the bad, but, like, it would be like if we had a bad call, like the worst call we ever had, and we sat there and we listened to it over and over and over again. It's just going to put negative reinforcement in your brain instead of positive. You want to hear something good and go, okay, that's what I need to do. Now I want to work on that. The positive reinforcement as opposed to bad. I remember taking a psychology course one time, and they basically said, like, if you were to tell yourself, don't miss it, and you kept saying, don't miss it, don't miss it, don't miss it, well, your brain apparently doesn't process the don't, and all that it hears is, miss it, you know, so it's almost like you're doing that, you're using this negative reinforcement. So I just, it's weird. I don't know how it's going to get the effect that Matt Nagy thinks it's going to get. And there's been a lot of, they've been auditioning all these different kickers. They had four guys at one point, and there was a one during an OTA practice a couple weeks ago. They had three kickers line up, attempted a 42-yard field goal with several Bears alumni and their families watching. One hit the right upright, one missed wide left, and the other missed wide right. So they all missed. So I don't know if they were showing that video before that practice or in the practices leading up to that, but again, it doesn't seem like they're focusing on the right thing if they want to move past that miss from last year.
It's funny because I think it's depending on the player how much you'd want to see that.
Yeah.
I'm going to use myself as an example. if my favorite team or teams lose a very hard game, I mean an extremely disappointing game, I avoid the highlights.
I do too.
I don't want to see it.
Close game, yeah.
Whether it's MLB Network's Quick Pitch or NHL Network's recap of games, I don't want to watch it. So I don't like to focus on the negatives right. of things. If there is something extremely positive, I will watch that. So for me, I would be totally turned off after about the second time I saw that kick. It would be something that would be Debbie Downer for me.
Right.
I like to move on. Like, if something happens at work that's a negative, you have a bad show, hey, let's turn the script, let's move on, because you got a chance to make up for it tomorrow. So it would not work well with me. If Nagy was showing that every day and I'm a player, I would absolutely be like, I'm done. I'm probably going to close my eyes. I'm not going to look, because I'm ready to move on to something more positive. So I think it depends on the player, but for me, that would absolutely be a huge negative, and I would absolutely tune out after a while that video.
Well, there's already, on any team, there's already such a negative opinion of kickers. And, you know, you've sat up there with Reggie Brooks, and we joke about it in the post-game show, but it's kind of the running joke. He's a kicker. He's got one job. His job is to kick it through the uprights. And so there's already such a sort of a negative feel for kickers from other guys. And I would just think that, like, if you're talking about linemen, you know, everybody, all these other positions, they're sitting there watching this. How is that going to make them feel any better about kickers in general? Because they're watching the same miss over and over again. I just feel like, again, Cody Parkey's not with the team anymore, so that there's no impact for him. The one guy who took part in it, he's not there anymore. You would think that if you were going to do something like that, you would find some videos of Chicago Bears kickers making kicks to try to give a better, a more positive spin to the whole thing. We're making this next time it happens. We're not going to miss it. We're making it. So, I don't know. It seems odd to me.
It is now 20 minutes after the top of the hour. Sean Steyer's Darren Pritchett with you. Rapid Fire next on WSBT.
Rapid Fire starts now on Budweiser's weekday sports beat on 96.1 WSBT. Here is Sean Steyer's and Darren Pritchett.
So a little fill in the blank with our first question tonight, Mr. Pritchett. It is blank that UConn is reportedly headed back to the Big East Conference.
I would say insignificant news for football. Significant news for basketball. Of course, we know revenue is all about football. Mm-hmm. You can ask, for example, Kansas, one of the great basketball programs in history. But because they were the football program that's not very good, it could affect them down the line in being in the appropriate conference.
Very true.
For football, UConn is kind of in no man's land. For Geno and the women's basketball program, they're going to play a little better competition than the American. And in terms of men's basketball, I think getting back to their roots may spark a little excitement back in the program, an original member of the Big East. So I think for the other sports, it's really, really good news. Football, I just think they're in a spot with Randy Edsall coming back. He has not been able to find the magic from when he beat Notre Dame at Notre Dame Stadium years ago when he had that program at least going in the right direction. I don't know if anything helps that football program right now.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be great for basketball, because they really sort of lost their identity, I think. They've just sort of been drifting around in the nether since joining the American Conference. And now they kind of get that East Coast footprint again. They'll get to play Villanova and Georgetown and all those old Big East schools, and of course the new ones as well. And interesting numbers with women's basketball, because I agree, it's a little bit of a step up. They won all 120 games in their six seasons in the American Conference. UConn women did. They were 314-18. 314 wins, 18 losses in 20 years in the Big East. And, of course, a good deal of the losses came to Notre Dame, who's not there anymore. So I don't think it's really going to be much of an effect there. But, I mean, when you think about UConn, especially in the Big East, the Big East schools that have football, they're FCS schools. So you don't have Division I FBS football. And the two conferences that I've heard are either the MAC or Conference USA. I mean,
or independent.
Yeah, which I think if you're UConn, that's going to be really tough trying to be UConn and be independent. You're almost better going back to being an FCS football program, if that's even possible. I don't know. But, yeah, it's going to be real tough for football. But men's basketball, and that's the basketball are obviously their bell towers anyway. So I think they'll be better off in both of those going back to the Big East. Okay, another fill in the blank. The homecoming reception for Albert Pujols in St. Louis this weekend was blank.
Well, I thought it was awesome. And I think some of the national media got one thing wrong, that this was unprecedented to see a home team cheering on a visiting player like the St. Louis fans did. I'm not taking away from what the Cardinal fans did. I thought it was awesome. Had I been there, I would have been cheering. But a couple of years ago, Chase Utley went back to the Phillies as a Dodger, hit a grand slam, and got a curtain call. So let's don't make out all the Cardinal fans to be saints and doing all this amazing stuff. This has been done before, but I don't think at this intensity. But I thought it was
awesome. That's a good point. I had forgotten about Chase Utley. That's very true, though. I remember that now that you say that. It's hard for me to believe that with interleague play, it's taken 8 years for Albert to get back there. But I guess with the format shifting and stuff like that.
Twice St. Louis played in Anaheim.
That's true, yeah. But he's just getting back into St. Louis now. And I did think it was great, especially his first at-bat, the first game, with the standing ovation lasted, what, like 90 seconds or something like that? It was a long ovation. They didn't want to sit down, and Yadier Molina played a big part in it. It was his first at-bat of every game. He got a ovation. I watched some of last night's game and saw some of that when he came up in the first inning, and I thought that was cool. The only thing that surprised me a little bit was, like, you've got some close games, and late in the game, the Cardinals fans are kind of turning on the home team a little bit, and they're booing Michael Wacha, and they're still cheering for Albert Pujols. I can see the appreciation with the first at bat of the game. You give him his due and that whole thing, but once the game starts, it's like, come on.
He's just different because he meant so much to that community.
I can see that.
I can't stress that enough, but also, that is a sign that the fan base does not believe in this team. They are frustrated with the front office. They are not good enough to be only two games in back of the Cubs, nearly as good as the Cubs and the Brewers. This, to me, is the fan base saying, we're not going to be that good anyway. We're not going to be a playoff team. So let's see a special moment with Albert. And to me, that's why there was so much excitement when he was doing something really good. Last night in the ninth inning, it's a 2-0 game. He came up with the bases loaded, nobody out. The fans were torn on what to do, to cheer or root against him. And I think a lot of them ended up just wanting to see a great moment. And again, because they know this team isn't that good and they lost their closer today, Jordan Hicks. He's going to need Tommy John surgery. He'll be done for a year and a half. So the tumble is coming. So I think the fans in St. Louis wanted to see something special from the second best player in franchise history.
All right. Okay, this next one. Cole Hamels picked up his 2,500th career strikeout recently against the White Sox, actually, last week. So he's over 2,500 for his career. Which category would you put Cole Hamels in? The Hall of Good, the Hall of Very Good, or the Hall of Fame, potentially?
Depends on how you look at it. You could make an argument statistically he's a Hall of Famer. When I look at Cole Hamels as a player using my baseball knowledge and adding in the stats, I think he's in the Hall of Very Good. He has never been a candidate for a Cy Young Award.
Right.
He has never been up for individual awards. He has been a very good pitcher throughout his career in Major League Baseball. And the Cubs made a wonderful trade to bring in Hamels. I mean, think about the rotation without him right now. He has been there backbone throughout this season. But is he a Hall of Famer? To me, you have to be something extra special. You have to have that signature moment. He had a no-hitter against the Cubs as a Philadelphia Philly. He had a really good postseason.
World Series MVP once.
And to me, the postseason stuff is icing on the cake, but the meat and the potatoes is what you accomplish in the regular season. I think statistically, you can make an argument Some of his analytical numbers line up with Mike Mussina, who just got into the Hall of Fame. But to me, when you factor in everything, he is in the Hall of very, very good.
And that's, I lean in that direction. He's the ninth left-hander in Major League history to get to 2,500, 38th pitcher overall. And he's actually was 105 days younger than Randy Johnson when Johnson got to his. Obviously, a difference there. They're both lefties, but Randy Johnson, much more a power pitcher. Little more than 2,600 career innings, 2,511 strikeouts. So really good right there. And all the stuff that you mentioned, was never a legitimate Cy Young candidate, all that stuff. A really good pitcher on some good teams and some bad teams as well. I know we've probably said this before, but it just gets harder all the time to figure out who is the Hall of Famer and who's not, because analytics has changed a lot of that, especially, I think, when it comes to pitchers. And you brought up Mike Mussina, and that's the big one. I mean, we don't have really these benchmark numbers anymore, like 300 wins. Cole Hamels isn't going to get to 300, but that also doesn't mean anything anymore because that's essentially a compilation stat. But on the other hand, the strikeouts is a big thing, and especially when you start to look at strikeouts to walks, strikeouts to innings. Hamels 8.8 strikeouts per nine compared to Mussina, who's in 7.1, and he's going to have more strikeouts. He's going to have a better ERA, and that's what you have to start doing now. It's like, okay, this guy got in. And that's, I've always thought, if Mike Mussina had never played for the New York Yankees, he wouldn't be a Hall of Famer.
I don't think he's a Hall of Famer.
No, I don't.
I would
either.
Not have voted for him.
Yeah.
I would not have voted for Jack Morris.
But that's where you've got these guys getting in now, and that's who you have to start comparing some of these guys to, and it's watering it all down.
And unfortunately, Harold Baines going in ruined
watered everything
so much
down.
And no disrespect to him, because he was a wonderful player, mainly for the White Sox. And I love you, Tony La Russa. You are my managing idol, but I'm sorry, Harold has watered down the Hall of Fame. And it's a shame because he's going to pay the price for what should be a wonderful weekend. But it's going to be, again, a hard weekend for him because there's going to be a lot of stuff written and said about him not being worthy.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Let's take a quick break. Okay. More Rapid Fire next on WSBT. It is now 22 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds by Train Heating and Cooling and the Food Bank of Northern Indiana. Hunger is a story we can end. Find out how at feedindiana.org. Sean Stiers, Darren Pritchett with you. We have a little more time left for Rapid Fire here on WSBT Radio.
All right, last question for tonight. I think Eric did something similar with his My Five in the first hour. Mets manager Mickey Callaway and pitcher Jason Vargas both got into heated verbal exchanges with the same newspaper reporter over the weekend. Have you, Darren, we've both worked in the media for a long time, have you ever had any sort of weird, awkward moments, heated or otherwise, in your time covering sports?
You asked me this during the commercial break, so you gave me a little advance. Two things come to mind. The first was just kind of funny at the BCS championship game down in Miami in 2012. We have the final media session in our hotel. It's Nick Saban and Brian Kelly, and right. I'm in the back just with my radio recorder plugged in back there with all the TV cameras, and it gets really quiet. The press conference gets underway, the media asking questions, and a cameraman forgot to turn off his ringer. And so going through the whole big area, this conference room, is Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. At least it wasn't like NSYNC.
That's true.
But it was one of those laughable moments where everybody got, it was really quiet and you could hear it plain as day. So that was kind of fun.
Right.
In terms of me, really the only thing that comes to mind when I had to fill in for the late Jeff Jeffers as the sideline reporter for Notre Dame football, the year that Notre Dame went to Michigan State and the Spartans had the fake field goal for the game-winning touchdown. Mm. Well, guess who got to interview Coach Kelly 30 seconds after that play happened?
Yeah.
That would be me, and it was the roughest interview I've ever had, and I asked a couple of questions, and it was just one of those moments. Hey, BK was frustrated, and I got it, but I could have said, you know, Brian, the sky's blue. He'd have been like, no, it's not. It's green. It just was one of those moments where I was in trouble.
There was no winning.
There was no winning, so that probably was the most difficult experience, but I've learned from it and figured out a better way to ask the questions that I asked.
Yeah.
So it was a learning experience, but whew, I had Don Crickey in my ear, too, after the interview.
Did not feel good on live radio. Yeah, I'm sure.
It was not pretty, to say the least.
I'm sure.
How about you?
The only one, I mean, there's always the, when you're at the post-game press conferences, after a team loses and the coach gets a question he doesn't like, you're always going to hear a little snipping and sniping. We've kind of seen that over the years. The only one with me personally is when Tyrone Willingham was head coach, the coordinators, the offensive and defensive coordinators, would come out and talk to the media afterwards. And I think it was 2004, which ended up being their last year. They got thumped by Purdue at home by like three plus touchdowns, I think. Purdue and that spread offense. And so Kent Bear, the defensive coordinator, came out. And I was doing post-game radio interview type thing. And I asked him something about Purdue's spread and how it, you know, the defense and the whole thing. And he kind of, whatever it was, he kind of snipped right back. And I just didn't really say much, just kind of cut it off. And again, doing the post-game stuff and just kind of went my own way. So that was, but I think you hit it on the head. It typically happens after the losses. These guys, it's their livelihood. They get paid and they're not happy about it sometimes afterwards. And it stirs some stuff up and you know, it's going to happen. I don't think it's anything personal. It's just guys care about their jobs and sometimes they hear something and they don't quite like it and they don't take it the way maybe it was intended sometimes. So that was
right
it.
Right place, right time, wrong place at wrong time. Yep. Sometimes that happens. That's going to wrap up Rapid Fire for tonight. Just want to mention Chris Smith, the local golfer, will be in the U.S. Senior Open. He'll tee off at 7:30 a.m., tee number one on Thursday. Also, and I have not got the correct pronunciation, so I do apologize, South Bend Clay grad from a few years ago, Tony Sorries. He's going to tee off at 9:47 Thursday on hole number 10 if you want to check him out.
All right.
And then in terms of some of the featured pairings to watch out for, 8:41 a.m. Thursday, hole 10, Retief Goosen, Tom Kite, and Tom Watson. 9:03 on number 10, Miguel Angel Jimenez and David Toms, the defending champion, will go out. 9:14 a.m. Thursday, John Cook and Lee Jansen will be going out. That's just some of the groups, and we'll talk more about these over the next couple of days. If you're going out there, be aware of those golfers on the golf course. It is now 17 minutes in front of the top of the hour at WSBT. Welcome back to Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat from 96.1 WSBT. The sports leader, I'm Darren Pritchett. U.S. Senior Open Golf Championship practice rounds underway today. First round coming up on Thursday. Recently, on the Corona Premier Golf Show, Tim Firestone from Blackthorn and myself spoke with Matt Seelan, the superintendent at Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame, and he spoke about all the preparations that have gone into the U.S. Senior Open coming to the University of Notre Dame. This is a week's worth of golf that's coming to Warren, but the preparation goes back many, many moons.
Absolutely. So my initial conversations begun 5 years ago about the possibility of holding yet another USGA event. At the time, and John can tell the story probably a little bit better than me, at the time there was an engagement between John and a fellow by the name of Joe Lewigs, who is a senior rules official for the USGA and will definitely be on site during the championship, about what would be next for the Warren Golf Course post having hosted the Women's Amateur Public Links in 2010. So that was the first time I remember anything actually happening. And that kind of led into a visit from the USGA after an official inquiry was made on their interest level in coming back and doing something with us. And that initial visit, where they actually walked the golf course and we started having deeper conversations, my best memory would probably be 3 years ago.
Okay.
So that process has been ongoing for a long time.
What was your initial reaction?
Excitement, for sure. John and I have been together now for just over 15 years that I've been at Warren. And early on, we kind of together had a game plan of wanting to do more. And what I mean by that is more than just hosting daily play events. Obviously, we wanted to promote the golf course, help with the college teams by getting some exposure for the facility. And it was easy early on because we were already set up to host some Big East championships. And then after the Big East days were done and over with, then we started kind of heading down the road of the NCAA regional events, which I think we've hosted now as of next year. We have another one coming. I believe it'll be our fourth or maybe even our fifth. So, and then it just kind of turned into the USGA. So it's been kind of, you know, like adding blocks. And we're at probably the pinnacle right now.
Well, I know the USGA, it is a popular conversation amongst fans and golfers about the setup of the golf courses, mainly the U.S. Open. U.S. Senior Open, there has not been as much fanfare about the setup, so we'll keep that conversation maybe for later. I'm just wondering, Matt, when you start working with the USGA years in advance of the U.S. Senior Open coming to Warren Golf Course, is one of the initial conversations they look at the golf course and they start thinking about making changes that might make it better?
Yeah, so the initial walk through the property, all the focus is on the golf course itself. The outside the rope operations, that comes along after they've decided if the property will fit to host a major championship. So we got our greatest compliment from then director, Jeff Hall was his name. He since has moved on inside the USGA. He's moved on and up. And we have another person in place now. But Jeff, on his initial visit walking around, paid us the compliment that they would tee the ball up just the way it is, play the golf course just the way it is without making any significant changes. However, there was a possibility that there might be some small things recommended. But they were never demanding on making anything major happen. We took the opportunity to make some changes that would be beneficial to both our daily fee play and then also the championship after the contract was signed with the USGA.
Just getting into maybe a thought or two on changes. With the changes, they've been in place now for probably over a year, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Some of the stuff is just kind of coming into maturity now, but the majority of the changes have been in place for a good year and a half.
I'm wondering, Matt, once these changes were put in place, is there one in particular, once you saw it and you thought to yourself, you know what, this makes the golf course better not only for the U.S. Senior Open, but also for our local golfers?
Yeah, absolutely. It would definitely be the expansion of the fairways in the landing areas. What the attempt is with the USGA and their recommendation on this, which Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw obviously agreed to, was to increase some of the landing areas specifically around the fairway bunkers. Because it's USGA's interest to try to drive the golf course down. Now any shot that lands anywhere in close proximity on the fairway that's good and firm is going to find its way into the bunker. Now, on a daily fee situation, we're not going to keep the golf course nearly as firm as what you would for a championship. And now you just increase the area, you know, for them to land a golf ball. So it definitely becomes more enjoyable and gives them more space on the property.
Matt, I'm curious, as far as firming up the fairways, have you guys been on a top dressing program on the fairways, or what have you done to firm up the fairways?
Yeah, excellent, Tim. I don't know if you've been out to the property in some time, but over the last 2 years, we've been on a very aggressive top dressing program on fairways, and we've had the greatest buy-in from our regular players and then also the pro shop staff and the assistants that there's going to be some times that we're going to impact play. But the reality is it's all beneficial for the long term. And what we've been able to build up over the last 2 years is just slightly over an inch of top dressing sand. And we're talking wall to wall all the way across the fairway, not just landing areas. And it's so important because of the consistency we have now in the fairways, Tim. The golf course was originally built on property that was kind of being reclaimed, so to speak. And it had a lot of different kind of hodgepodge of soil types, so we didn't have a lot of consistency. On one hole, you might get 30 yards of roll. The next hole, the ball might literally back up. And with the top dressing program in place, it's significant how consistent they are. It helps with my water management, and I'm telling you, if you play on a regular basis out there, chances are you're going to get easily 15 yards of roll off a tee shot.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think, to your point, that the local golfer, I mean, it really knows or experiences that. I don't think there's a local course in our market that really is on any type of a top dressing on the fairway program. But it's, when you play a golf course that does, you can definitely notice the difference between the firm, fast fairways compared to what you typically see on a daily basis. And it's, you know, a lot of times it could be more enjoyable to play. You're getting hit the ball further and seeing it kind of tumble and run out 20, 30 yards rather than just hitting his plug and spinning it back.
Yeah.
Also curious, as far as the course preparations go, and as you guys are getting ramped up here, when will you guys shut down? I know that the USGA's got some restrictions on that. When will you guys close, and when will you open back up?
Well, it's interesting. It sounds like your closure and our closure are going to work out beautifully for one another. So
that was kind of why I was asking the question. I think that
you did that. You did that beautifully. You led in perfectly on that. So to give you the exact dates, I'm going to pull it up here. The exact dates are, so we're done with public play as of the 9th of June. We are going to go to walking only on the 4th of June. So right around the corner here, we're going to go to walking only. So we're going to remove the carts for a period of time. Obviously, turf health being the main reason for that, especially with all the rain that we've had, Tim, as you well know out there at Blackthorn. Mm-hmm. It's difficult on a property like ours where we do not have cart paths for around the entire golf course.
Mm-hmm.
So removing the carts is going to help us cut down on the traffic a little bit, maybe let some of those wear areas around cart paths thicken up a little bit. And then we'll go to closing the golf course. Like I said, the 9th, I believe, is the last day that the golf course will be open in any capacity. And then after that, we're going to have a bit of a time frame where we are technically close to all play. I understand that we may see an occasional practice round being played, but really the majority of the practice rounds are going to be in advance week or prep week, which is the week before the championship.
Corona Premier Golf Show on WSBT Radio. Matt Seelan, superintendent at Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame. Tim Firestone, Darren Pritchett with you on this Saturday morning, talking about Matt working with the USGA, getting his golf course ready for the U.S. Senior Open. When you think about the changes from this standpoint, was there one change that the USGA went ahead and did to the golf course that surprised you, that they wanted to do it? And again, once you saw it, it's like, wow, that really works well.
No, you know, everything was always communicated.
Mm-hmm.
We always had a team atmosphere on the buy-in, whether it was the architects or the USGA or even suggestions that I made.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all worked together on it. So there was nothing that really surprised me. I guess the one thing that could be surprising to others is I made a recommendation early on to expand what's going to be our championship number 2 green. And expanding a green is a lot of work and a very difficult assignment when you're trying to expand it without basically rebuilding the entire green. So you're just going to add a section to it. It's almost impossible to get the thing to line up to where it's matches up well with the existing putting surface. And I was kind of surprised that they bought into my abilities to do it. Obviously, they didn't have a lot of experience with me, but with the support from Ben Crenshaw and Bill Kaur, they went ahead with it. And you know what? It's been very successful. If you've not experienced it out on the golf course, it was our 17th hole, which will be now be played as our championship number 2. The back left section of that green, it's a par 5, and I had always had an issue with it being such a small green and receiving wedge shots and the kind of wear and tear that it would take. So we expanded it almost a quarter and giving us probably another additional 3 to 4 hole locations. I know for sure there's going to be at least one utilized during the championship in that area. So, and that was only a year and a half ago. And that surface is right now being mowed at the same as the rest of the putting green. You can't really not tell.
Congratulations. That's quite a challenge to take on right before a national championship comes to your golf course. So, again, that's number 17 as we played it at Warren, and that'll be championship number 2, which leads to this question that many in the public probably are wondering about. It is the rerouting of holes. What is the major reason why the golf course will not play the way that we normally play it?
It's the flow of traffic, really. So our 16th, 17th, and 18th, as Warren had always been played, would have been really difficult to get people out on. And obviously you want to build the excitement on the back nine. And that would have been a difficult to move people from point A to point B without having a lot of issues. So had it not been, you know, where it was on the golf course, didn't, had it not needed to utilize bridges, I'm sure we probably wouldn't have looked at going down that route. So the current, the best part about the way that the golf course is now laid out from the championship is you're finishing with a par 3, a par 5, and an extremely challenging par 4. And I think it's going to build all the drama that they want, having the new setup.
That was Matt Seelan, superintendent of Warren Golf Course at Notre Dame, speaking on the preparations for the U.S. Senior Open. Practice rounds continue tomorrow and Wednesday at Warren. The first round of the U.S. Senior Open is Thursday. Budweiser's weekday sports beat will be live from the U.S. Senior Open Wednesday through Friday with special three-hour programming from 4 until 7 o'clock. And then this Saturday at 8 a.m., it's the Corona Premier Golf Show here on WSBT Radio. Budweiser's weekday sports beat brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. For Sean Stiers, I'm Darren Pritchett. It is the top of the hour, 96.1 WSBT South Bend, the sports leader.